Welcome to episode 45 of Talking Prisoner. Our guest today is an actress, award-winning author, journalist, artist, and a real fan favorite. She's appeared in many Australian classic TV shows and movies, including The Sullivans, Skyways, All the Green Years, I Can Jump Puddles, Cop Shop, Every Move She Makes, Kelly, Say a Little Prayer, Janus, Corelli, Law of the Land, Road to Nil, Stingers, Fergus, Blue Heelers, and MDA. Our guest has also written award-winning books, including Listening for Small Sounds and Another Man's Office. But more importantly, our guest has appeared in 139 episodes of Prisoner, and her mother was the late, great Mari Trevor, who was a producer on Prisoner and many other classic Australian TV shows. We're, of course, talking about Lexi Patterson, played by Pepe Trevor. Welcome to Talking Prisoner.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Ken.
Ken.
Hello there.
Hey, it's darling. I'm very honoured to be here.
Thank you so
much. Only 37 years.
Yeah, I know. You don't look a day older, darling.
And that's only to you, Matt.
Nice to me. Oh, I thought it was about you.
He wasn't even born, I don't think, back then.
I was born in 78. So.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Everybody looks profoundly young to me these days.
Me too.
Yeah.
Now, we've got a lot to cover because I don't know if you know, but you're a real fan favourite. The fans have been reaching out every week wondering when this interview's happening, and it's been going crazy. So we will try and get through everything we can. If not, we'll come back for a part two. Now, before we get into Prisoner, can we just learn a little about your life growing up? Where did you grow up as a child?
When I got your question about this, it was kind of funny. It made me realise didn't really have, up until I was seven, I had a very abnormal childhood. We pretty much lived in a tent most of the time. And I remember three houses my parents rented in theatre season when we came back to Sydney. And my mum and dad primarily my dad, but also my mother, were in whatever plays were on at the Sydney Theatre Company that season. And during that time, they did radio plays and things as well. So the rest of the time, we kind of lived like gypsies. My dad had a big Birkemeyer tent and we just travelled up and down the East Coast and camped in places. It was very different then. You could just go to small towns and camp on the banks of the river. And Mum and I would go and sit in the ladies' lounge if it was raining, or out on the veranda at meal times. And my dad would go into the public bar and he would recite Banjo Paterson poems and excerpts from Shakespeare and current plays that he'd done last season, and our meals would be free.
Wow.
So I don't think I realised probably until recently that made a number of normal things children go through really difficult for me, like going to school and this institution where you had to pull up your socks, or like I was in a total chaos about most of that stuff for a lot of my life. So those first 7 years were pretty extraordinary. I had a lot of time alone, a lot of time just in land, country. I learned to fish for food. And that was our meal. And and that's always really stayed with me. It's been the core of me. And I was really, you know, it was never good when we came to town. And so I think there's a line in an old Sandra Bullock movie, "With the sweets come the bitter." And so there was a lot of really wonderful stuff about my childhood, but it was tinged with some very bitter things. And a lot of that bitterness was when my father was contained in a house with four walls. Things were much worse then. So I actually preferred the tent, and I've always been much happier in the country because they were my safe places, really.
Do you think the kids today miss out because they're so cooped up inside with electronic devices and everything like that, compared to like how you grew up, being outside and living like that? Would be a real benefit, I think.
Yeah, no, it really was. And I really actively tried to give my own children a taste of that. Yeah. And I think that was probably most obvious for my youngest when, like, he was the one of my kids who I'd managed to actually give the right things to. Like, he'd been at the same kindergarten with the same people. He went to the same primary school. It was all balanced. Everything was like it should be. And he's highly, highly intelligent. And when he was about 9 heading to 10, he became a really little bit of a turd. And his value system, I could see, was really a little bit unbalanced. Like, he wasn't, I mean, I'm his mum, I guess I imposed this on him, but he wanted the Nike shoes and he wanted to be cool. And it was really concerning me. He was developing a limited view. So at that time, it was quite hard for him, but I sold his home that he'd grown up in and went back to Nepal with him for about 2 years. And he went to a Nepali international school for 3 months. And it was a real shock for him. Like, when we first arrived in Nepal, I don't think he left the hotel room for 2 weeks. He was just in total shock. And he watched videos on this little video player. And he was like, this is sanity. What's out there? Where has my mother brought me? And when we first arrived, where we were living, it was the Bodhanath Stupa. And you go in the main gate and there's a big stupa. And we went to walk around it and all the begging kids came running up to him, little white boy, you know. He looks really affluent. And they're, you know, paisa, paisa, oh, you know. And he was just totally freaked out. And when we got inside and talked about it, he said, this isn't fair, Mum. I mean, we're not rich, you know. And why do they want all this stuff from me? And I hugged him and said, honey, from their perspective, we're really rich, you know. A year later, those same kids he'd been frightened of were his friends.
Oh, okay.
And in the morning, he'd go down to the stupa and they'd all gather all the kids and be up to all sorts of mischief. And fella would go out begging with them and say, hey, there's an American couple just got off the tourist bus. And so all the kids had run up there. And when the police came to the stupa to chase the beggars out, fella would run with the kids. And I wouldn't worry because I'd know, I'd just go to the cafe which sold really good ice cream and I'd know that in 10, 15 minutes he'd turn up through the back door of the cafe with about 6 of his little friends and I'd buy them all ice cream. And now at 24, he says to me, thanks, Mum, it was the best thing you could have done for me.
Wow.
So sometimes being a parent, you've got to make hard decisions, but you hope it gives your kids something, some good roots.
I know we'll probably talk about this, but what made you move over there at the time?
Tibetan Buddhism.
Okay.
I mean, I was very lucky. It was a long time ago, and there were still alive then some of the extraordinary old masters who had come out of Tibet, and there wasn't a big institution around them. So the kind of intimate access, I really am very, very lucky to have received.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
Amazing.
I mean, now there are wonderful institutions that anyone can go and study, get doctorates and PhDs, as well as be practitioners. I mean, that's really wonderful. But probably for me, and I'm not very good with structure, I think it was really fortunate that I just met these people at a time when things were very real.
Awesome.
Can we can we take you back to your school days, and did you have a favourite or an unfavourite subject?
Oh, yeah. No, my favourite subjects, one was physics, which I totally adored, but I do not have a mathematical bone in my body. But the philosophical aspects of physics, I just adored. And the same with chemistry, like the way particles interact and different chemicals interact. And that really tied in with art, of course.
Yeah.
And the art room was my solace at school. I would sneak in there whenever I could. And I actually had, in the last 2 years of school, a really wonderful art teacher called Anne Hurley. And she gave me really open slather on the art room. Like, she never questioned when I was there, even if it was because I wasn't at a sports class. So that kind of freedom I was given. But ironically also, so physics, art, they wouldn't let me continue with physics because I was so bad at maths. They would now, but they didn't then. And I adored history. But I don't know that I was crash hot at it from a history teacher's point of view. What I adored about history and I feel is really important is the human cycles, how we keep repeating the same mistakes, how there's so much to be learnt from that pattern if we'd only look. And I think that's one of the reasons that I really wish more history was taught in schools these days. Like, I think I'm the last generation that had a classic education. Like, I hated Latin, was no good at it, but I'm really glad I did it.
Yeah. Now, I know this interview is about you, but if we can just take a few minutes to talk about your legendary mum, who was a producer on Prisoner and also many
other... I'm sorry, we can't take a few minutes, Matt. To talk about my mother is going to take a lot longer than a few minutes.
Well, I mean, many fans still talk about your mum, and just recently I uploaded that footage of Sammy Davis Jr. visiting the Prisoner set, and there was some footage of your mum on that, and the fans just, you know, they loved it because there's not a lot of footage of your mum. And, there's a lot of fans that, and myself included, would love to find out a bit more about your mum if we can.
Oh, happy to talk about my mum. I mean, I think it's really important to maybe start at the point where her personal career could really take off. And honour that. And in the light of the Me Too movement, there's going to be an aspect to that story or that opening or freedom. That I guess I'm going to be quite candid about. And that was, my dad died on my 9th birthday. It was the first time in my life that I was having a birthday party and going out for a birthday dinner, which I think my mum had orchestrated because I was getting older. Anyway, we went out for this meal. He didn't make it through the meal. He was dead 12 hours later.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, that's a whole story too. And I do need to say I don't want to paint my father just as a devil, but I need to honour both my mother and my father's story. So I am actually one generation removed from slavery. My father was an indentured worker taken from England at the age of 12, literally sold by his father, who had taken both my father and his brother, from their mother out of sheer spite, wouldn't let them see her. She actually tracked them down. That's a whole other story. But it's important to understand the trauma that he had been under as a child. So, yes, there were aspects of my mother's life that were profoundly violent. So he dies, and she lived that in secrecy, as many women back then did.
Yep.
So my dad dies. Sorry to start in a downer, guys. Promise the story gets better. So he died, and he was directing Hunter at that time, and she was the casting director. And a wonderful woman called Dorothy Crawford, who I think had been the first female producer, a director of any kind of weekly television or when television started. I'm pretty sure Dorothy had done one or two episodes, but she was then the producer. So you've got this tiny little woman who was even smaller than Mum and I, who basically got the whole Crawfords thing going.
Oh, wow.
So my dad drops dead. The show must go on. Who are they going to direct it? They knew my mum was the casting agent. She knew all the crew. She knew the actors. She casted most of them. And she understood how my father worked dramatically because he had run through all the scenes. So she was told, and she had to, financially, you're now the director of Hunter.
Oh, wow.
So I am pretty sure that my mother was the first female director of a weekly series in this country.
Wow. How amazing.
And I think she should really be honored for that. She dived into it with a joy and a freedom of expression that was inspiring. And it was wonderful to see her blooming after a relationship which she had to keep small in. She suddenly had a vehicle for all that creativity that was in her. She knew nothing about cinematography. So her cameramen, she would explain what she wanted. They would work out the shots, and they would then teach her how they were translating the shots or the sound into her vision of a scene. And I remember the five C's of cinematography open, and Mum studying. So that was the beginning of one of the greatest joys in her life, which was her career.
Wow.
And the cast and crew, particularly the side of the crew, like she adored crew. She valued all their skills right across the board, makeup, hair, sound, the cameramen. That was the world she was totally comfortable in, and then with actors. And later on, that translated into her storylining team. You know, she loved to give young people a chance, a go. And she talked about, you know, her boys. And that was her group, even though there were girls in it. Yeah, sorry, I rambled a bit.
No, this is great. Love hearing about your mum. Yeah.
So that was, you know, she adored work. And she really didn't like having to give up work when the ABC could no longer insure her because she was too old.
Oh, my gosh.
She was 70 then, but it was hard for her. Work was pretty much everything on that level.
Yeah. And yeah. Do you have any memories of her on Prisoner, the days from Prisoner? When?
Look, my relationship with my mum was really deep and really quite complicated, but we understood each other without words on a whole range of issues. One being when I was, she wasn't particularly rapt, I got the job in prison.
Yeah, actually, that's one thing I want to actually give, we can just quickly talk about, because there's a lot of, wrong information online with fans on Facebook and things.
I wouldn't know because I'm not online.
I know you're not on there, but, you know, they say, oh, you know, she would have only got the part because her mum was a producer on the show and everything like that. So, yeah, can we, because we know that's not true.
No, my mother's biggest fear is what they're saying. Oh, she'd just be horrified. Poor mum. No, I definitely did not get the job through my mother. I don't know whether it was my agent, Barbara Gange, who recommended me for the part, like when Jan Russ sent the part through to the agents, or whether it was Jan Russ who asked for me to audition, amongst many other people. Like, I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that my agent rang me and sent me through the script, or told me then you had to go and pick it up physically in those days. And I read the character of Lexia and I just loved her. And my mother was in Sydney. I don't know why she was in Sydney, but she was up doing something for Grundy's. And it happened very quickly. It was like I got the script and my audition was 2-3 days later or something. And it was with Jan Russ, and I knew my mum was in Sydney. So anyway, I just didn't think about my mum. I worked on the scenes and I went and did the audition, which we can talk about later. But when my mum got back and Jan had made her choice, which was me, apparently mum asked to see all the audition tapes. Usually she just accepted Jan's recommendation. But she watched all the audition tapes and she must have thought I was okay because I did get the job. But the only thing she ever said to me was one night before I started filming, and I was over with Tashi just doing grandma family stuff, not talking about work. And as I went to leave, she said, yes, well, I watched all the audition tapes and you were the best out of a very mediocre bunch.
How good is that? And what a process. I mean, Coral Druin creating your character.
Yeah.
And then Jan Russ, you know, one of the legendary casting directors casting you. I mean, what a process. And then having your mum.
I do have to say, like, mum was kind of caught in a very tricky situation because my mum had extraordinary creative honour and she was really old school. And I remember this from when she was the casting director in Division 4. No, the director of Division 4. I think it was Division 4 in the early days. There was a particular guest role and the best person for the role was a person my father had had an affair with.
Oh, okay.
My mother cast her.
And did your mum know that?
Yep, my mother cast her. She was the best for the role. So when it came to her daughter getting a role, at least she showed the same sort of, you know, creative integrity.
Wow. Well, there we have it. So you got that part of Lexi on your own merits via Jan Russ and not your mum, but your mum did think you were the best out of the lot. But I'm glad we could.
Out of a mediocre bunch of auditions.
Yes, she would throw that word in, wouldn't she?
Oh, absolutely, Ken.
And you knew Mari as well, Ken, yeah?
I worked on a television series called The Box.
Yeah.
And Mari was one of the many directors on The Box as well. So, yes, I knew her before, well and truly before I knew you.
Yeah. Wow. I was that annoying little kid who'd come and sit in the control room sometimes.
Probably.
Yeah. I was kind of keeping out of the way, Ken, so you didn't notice me much.
Tell us about, well,
sorry, Ken, can we just go back 1 minute? Sorry, I always go off topic a little bit, but with your dad, just quickly, so he was a director on a lot of other TV shows as well, or was just
television had just started when my dad was a director. Like we came to Melbourne when I was seven and Hunter had just started. The whole Crawford Productions world and industry and studios was just beginning. And suddenly from, acting having a very limited connection with the public, thanks to TV, it was growing. There was this huge industry that was about to flower. So my dad got his first regular job.
Wow.
And came to Melbourne. And Dorothy Crawford, who really was an amazing lady. I remember her, I was very young, but there was something about this woman. She had the grace of another time. Astutely intelligent, profoundly compassionate, yet in her own quiet way, she just cut a path into a very male-dominated world, and she was the best at it.
Wow.
She was quite an extraordinary woman.
Amazing. And I'm going to throw another hard question at you just quickly, if you can remember. What would be one of the great things that your mum loved about Prisoner? Would do you remember something that she would always talk about with Prisoner that she adored, that she loved?
Oh, look, it was, Ken would remember even from the box. It was that process of everyone coming together. That's how my mum loved to work. Yeah. So it was the storylining. It was, she always had Friday night drinks in the office or, would come down to the Burvale Hotel with Prisoner to go with the crew to the Burvale Hotel. The crew, the storyliners, and then the actors coming in and bringing to life that vision. It was that whole ensemble. I believe she was a really good producer.
Yeah.
Because part of production is getting everyone to work together. And I'm sure she offended a few people along the way, and I'm sure people have a myriad of different, she was no saint, I'm not saying that, but genuinely passionate about the creative process that was an ensemble approach.
Yeah.
And that's very much what I'd been brought up with at home. And so I think really, although it was TV, for me, Prisoner was like stepping into that, learning your straps, that integrity of in the old days, the actors went to England and they did rep, they did turnaround plays every week, every 2 weeks. And, I stepped into Prisoner and we were doing 2 hours a week. It was the same kind of thing. So it was about, bringing your full energy to the moment whilst learning your lines for the next week and just being in this constant process of learning your craft.
Wow. And just quickly, you just mentioned the Burvale Hotel, which is, for the fans that don't know, is a hotel pub in Vermont, which is just down the road from the Channel 10 studios. But Ken's got a very interesting story, which we spoke about in episode 1 about a lunch that he had at the Burvale with Ian Bradley, wasn't it?
I'd never been to the Burvale, ever. No, I'm telling a lie. I used to, it was about a 9-minute walk from Channel 10 to the Burvale if you went on foot. I had drinks with the first director, Graham Arthur, and Ian Bradley down at the Burvale before we began production. And Graham rang me up and he said, look, I'm going to be directing this show, whatever it's going to be called. And
it had no name at that stage, did it?
No, it had a working name, but it didn't have a definite name. And he said, I've got this guy by the name of Ian Bradley who is going to be producing. And what are you doing? And I said, I'm doing the news at 6 o'clock. And he said, well, it's 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Come down to the Burvale and we'll have drinks. So I went down there and we chatted and I met Ian for the first time, and with Graham, who used to be my old head cameraman at Channel 7. And so we just chewed the fat about, you know, a lot of different things about what was going to happen, where it was going to happen, how it was going to happen, and also what the hell the thing was going to be called.
I love this story.
So Ian was still, he said, look, we're calling it Prisoner as a working sort of title at the moment, but we don't know whether it's going to be women in prison or, you know, all sorts of different alternatives. And I said, just off the top of my head, well, I think Prisoner is a good name. I'm not taking any credit for naming
you can, Ken. It's okay.
The credit.
Nothing to do with that. But Ian said, but yeah, well, hang on. There's been another program in England a couple of years ago called The Prisoner with Patrick McGoohan. And I said, yes, that's in the past. This is about women in prison. And he said, well, yeah, but Prisoner doesn't cut it. You know, it doesn't tell you it's women in prison. And I said, no, but it sure sticks in your mind. You know, just one word, a one word title. And homicide, hunter.
Yes.
I worked on homicide. They stick in your mind.
Yeah.
They do.
And so we all went our different ways. They went back to their offices or whatever, and I went back and did the news.
Oh, wow. Hang on, guys. I've just got to turn the heater on. It's suddenly getting cold.
That's okay. We should hold an event at the Burvale.
That'd be hysterical.
There's been many events at the Burvale.
Yeah, there's been many events at the Burvale. One of my favourite childhood memories was when Mum would take me to the Burvale. I don't know what show it was over, and it wasn't when I was in Prisoner, it was when I was younger. And they had a smorgasbord, and you would get beetroot salad with onion rings, and I thought that was fantastic.
Yes, we had a drinking smorgasbord as well.
Yes.
But it was a renowned hotel that I remember growing up. There's always something going on there. There was always fights and dramas. It was, I mean, I remember always being on the news. It was a real rough hotel.
It was a very well-renowned hotel simply because my wife, Maria, worked there.
Maria worked there?
She was a receptionist.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Sorry, Ken.
Just moving on a bit.
Okay, sorry, guys. We got a bit sidetracked.
We can tell, and all the fans can tell, over your shoulder that you are an artist. Tell us when you started painting.
I started drawing with ink when I was about 11, just after my dad had died. He'd actually was quite a good artist, and we had two drawings in the house that were ink and pen. And so I started drawing with ink and pen. But it was when I was 13 years old. There's a writer you might remember called Louis Bionis. You remember him, Ken?
No.
Okay. Well, he was a Spanish guy who wrote a lot for all the Crawford productions. He was this mad dilettante who could play brilliant classical piano and amazing jazz. He was an incredible sort of crazy Spanish writer. You know, we had some incredible writers back then. He was also an artist and very close. He and his wife, Lynn, were very close friends of my mother's. And Lewis started teaching me how to paint with his oils. And I know it's maybe 45 years later, because I was about 15 by the time, he gave me his paints, his old paints, because he was no longer painting. So from 15 on, I had this amazing, you know, all used crumpled tubes, but beautiful European paints. And I haven't stopped painting since.
Wow. There's some amazing work there.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Yeah, definitely. Ken.
Now, Matt, you're going to talk about...
Well, yes. Now, we're working on your website, which is under PenelopeTrevor.com, which we are currently, it's all nearly finished. So most of your work will be available on that website for purchase, which will be great, and a lot of other things, books and things. So that'll be great to see. And also at the event on August the 7th, we're going to have some of your artwork featured there that fans can also buy on the day. And have signed by you as well, which will be amazing. So the event is at the Harlow Bar at 447 Church Street. I'll just give it a quick plug in Richmond. There's a handful of tickets still left on the talkingprisoner.com website, only $89. And you're going to see Pepe, you're going to see Ken, Desiree, and of course, Maxine. So it'll be a lot of fun. So please jump on that. But the website, very excited about. Favorite food? Do you have a favorite food that you like?
Oh man, favorite food. Look, I love good food. I love good, clean, homegrown food. So I have a veggie garden, and honestly, the vegetables that come out of that are incredible. I do love lobster, not that I get to eat it very often anymore, but I think I love lobster so much because when I was a kid and we were living on the East Coast, we used to go to the fishing boats when they came in the afternoon, and my dad would give me a penny. Yes, I am old enough to remember a penny, that ugly brown coin. That's why my name is Peppy. I didn't want to be called after an ugly brown coin. But my dad would give me a penny. I'd go to the fishing boat and you could get a whole bag of claws, lobster claws, for a penny. Wow. And we would sit on the pier with white vinegar, a loaf of white bread, and eat lobster. Oh. It was a pretty special thing. So... yeah, lobster is one of my favourite foods.
Very nice.
What sort of TV shows are you keen on?
Oh.
Shortlist.
Look, I saw an amazing show. Well, I found it amazing anyway, called The Anatomy of a Scandal. Has just come out of Britain. I don't in some ways watch a lot of TV.
That's okay.
So occasionally I binge something. Anatomy of a Scandal was one of them. The Witcher was another. I really like that. I really like Firefly. So I have a little bit of a strange taste. Often things that I find I might write or appreciate their creativity or their need to be made, or even love to be in, I can't actually watch. it's too painful, and I get too upset. Doesn't mean I don't really respect those shows or think they're dealing with really wonderful things. I've just got to a stage in my life where I tread gently with myself.
Understand. Now, you worked on a lot of other shows before Prison, like Cop Shop and The Sullivans and things. Do you have any memories of working on those shows? Well, we're going too far back.
Look, I think it's hard to explain that time back then.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking a lot about it lately. There was such a big industry of really Australian shows made back then that there were so many of us who actually could have a really genuine, viable acting career. And I'm sure it's the same for the crew, you know, from your side, Ken, and from storyliner sides. There were so many shows going that you could really live. You would be a guest in a show for a couple of weeks and then you'd be in another show. And it was much more like the British system. You know, if you watch a lot of British TV, you'll see the same actors coming up again and again, playing a myriad of different roles. And what happens in that situation is you're continually running into people you've already worked with, I think the work gets better. And yes, you have your regulars in shows, like I was in Prisoner, but the guest actors will have been regulars in another show at another time. So there was this really rich, creative performance culture, I think, in Melbourne, particularly at that time.
Yeah.
So it was always familiar. It didn't really matter what show you were stepping onto the set of. You would know half the cast. Mm-hmm. You'd know half the crew. So it was always catching up with old friends, and everyone was still working fast because all those shows we were churning them out. Like, it was a really wonderful and exciting time. Yeah, we worked really hard.
Yeah.
We worked really long hours, but you felt like you were creating something, and something that was genuinely Australian. And I know a lot of people probably won't like me saying this, but I don't feel we have the same rich industry, purely Australian industry, that we had back then. And I do feel the only light I see to do with that is a very rich backlog of must-be-told narratives coming from our first Australians and some of those projects that are happening and coming through now. That's got a feeling to me of a real Australian industry and gives me hope that we might actually be able to generate that same kind of industry in a contemporary way. I don't mean going backwards, but where there's shows genuinely from the grassroots told here and backed by Australian money and Australian companies. And really, so we are allowed to develop a truly culturally specific narrative that I feel is really important, not just for Australia, but also globally, because there is something important about how we approach these stories that should have been told a long time ago and how we embrace it. And it's exciting. So I just hope that that continues in a genuine grassroots way and is not just a fad we pass through.
Yeah.
Sorry, but I'm a little soapbox.
No, that's a good point, though. I mean, I just recently just watched the Newsreader, which I should have watched a long time ago, but that drama on the ABC, and it's going back to the, it's based on the 80s newsrooms and things like that in Melbourne. And it's fantastic. It was amazing. I binge watched six episodes, whatever it was. And
I watched a couple of episodes and thought it was amazing. But for me, I loved all that and I went, whoa, enough at the moment.
So that leads us into you getting into journalism. Tell us about
that. I wrote a series, I was offered through the Melbourne Times a weekly column, which was great. I was like, really? And they were, yep, you can write on whatever you want to write on. So I think I actually ended up doing four articles for them. And they were a little bit challenged by all of them. Apparently I'm really controversial, Ken. Which astounds me, but anyway. And the fifth article I wrote, I lost my job because I wrote an article about, it's such a long time ago, but the fifth article I wrote was basically about women and countries that were accepted into the female human rights body. I'm really bad at acronyms. I had it all right in the article, but it was a long time ago. And that the only reason this, my contention was the only reason these countries that denied women any sort of political rights could still be accepted globally was because our own governments still considered women to be either property of first their family and second the state. So when I gave them my article, I was called into the office and said, you told you can't say this. And I said, but it's just an opinion piece and it's based on my research and it's my opinion. I take full responsibility. And they just refused to publish it. And I went, okay, well, that's so that was my brief sojourn into journalism again.
What do you think about now though, with all the Twitter and Facebook and everything and people getting banned across platforms for things that they talk? I mean, we know the big one, Donald Trump being banned from Twitter. Not bringing Donald Trump into this, but what do you think about the whole free speech these days? People talking about.
It's a really big conversation to have. What I don't really understand is most people believe that we have laws about inciting violence and inciting hatred. That you're not allowed to do that publicly, for no good reason.
Yeah.
Yet it seems that there's one group of people who continually step over that line and it's not helpful, it's not beneficial. I think part of the reason, however, that they get as much notice as they do is because of the media. If the media simply stopped reporting what Trump says, he'd have his Twitter feed, whatever. But because the drama of Trump is good entertainment and saleable, I think our media outlets have a lot of lot more responsibility than they actually take on. In terms of silencing speech, I think if we keep the rules very, very small, So they really, because it's dangerous territory. Once you start silencing people, you're heading towards an unhealthy situation. But there is a balance in terms of intelligent debate. And I think globally, and definitely in Australia in the past, this has been missing. So we can't, it's like, say, with the whole vaccine, COVID vaccine. I did my nursing at one stage and I really had some concerns about certain aspects of certain vaccines, okay? Because a more extreme view took hold of that debate, you couldn't actually even have a debate. Yeah. It became completely polarized.
That's true.
So when I was trying to say to my own kids, look, guys, go have this vaccine. I'm a little concerned about this. Just a bit more research. They were like, what? You're an anti-vaxxer? I'm like, look, no, I have nothing. No, that's, I'm trying to have an intelligent discussion with you. But the media had already polarized it so much and engendered so much fear on both sides that it wasn't helpful. And I think it stopped us as a country having an intelligent conversation about new technologies, where they actually are, and respecting each person's private choice. Because nobody's situation is the same.
Yeah, that's true.
And we just lost that respect and that ability to have a proper conversation. And I think it's that way with a lot of things, that the issues get polarized, and because of that, it triggers emotion. Once people get emotional, it's very, very hard to have a rational discussion about anything.
That is the most sensible words I've ever heard in the last few years. You should be running for politics. But sure, you can't have a conversation with anyone anymore because you're either going to offend them or they're going to get upset or have an argument.
I would say, before we move on, that is something as a child, like after my dad died and it was just mum and I, mum was working, something I thrived on as a child was the dinner parties mum had, most of which I cooked for because she was busy working, so I get already. The conversation around those tables of issues and philosophy and notions of ethics and those dinner table conversations about politics and the passion of the Make It Australia campaign when I was 13 and being allowed to be part of that with all the actors back then and really fight for a Make It Australia, you know, it was really informed. It wasn't aggressive, but it was really a wonderful thing to have those dinner parties and that conversation. And I wish that was more a part of everybody's life around their own dinner tables now. I think it's really important that we all talk and we exchange ideas so we can learn and evolve rather than go backwards and make the same mistakes.
Yeah.
So thanks, Mum, for the dinner parties.
Ken, I'll let you take my question because it ties in with your question as well.
How did you come to write your 1996 book, Listening for Small Sounds, and your 2000 book, Another Man's Office? How did you come up with the plots?
Okay. So Listening for Small Sounds is faction.
Yeah.
So I wanted to acknowledge the life that my mother had experienced, and I wanted to help her dissolve Like from the time my dad died, we never talked about the violence. We just pushed it down and we created a wonderful life between the two of us and our animals, and we healed. And, oh, sorry, I'm just suddenly missing my mum a lot.
Oh, sorry, we can stop for a minute if you like.
No, it's fine. Hey, emotion's part and parcel of life. But after I'd had my second son, my mum adored her grandkids. She really did. And I think part of that was she hadn't really been allowed to adore having a child because my dad was very jealous. So it was a tense situation, and mum and I had to be very careful not to poke the bull. So after he died, we created this life. But suddenly with her grandkids, there were these babies she was allowed to love, you know, and that was a really healing process. So as that went on, I started writing. There's a lot I wrote that isn't in that book that was just for mum and I. So I started writing, and every night, every second night, at that stage, like, I made sure mum wasn't alone. Like, she came to dinner at the house pretty much every night. She was very much a part of our life. She really needed that after she stopped work because there was nothing else, you know, and it was all this time for these memories, I suppose, began to bubble up in her, not that she talked about them. So I started writing, and so she'd be over, we'd have dinner, the kids would go off and do whatever, and I'd read her what I had written. So everything in that first book was okayed by my mum to actually go in the published version. But it was a process of healing between my mum and I. It was a process of me acknowledging to her what she'd been through and that she'd been witnessed. And there was no language for it back then. I mean, I think I've watched the young women now and I'm so grateful to them because they're even giving me a language for things I didn't even question. And I had no language to talk about. And it's like, oh my God, that's what that was. And we did, we just swallowed it, you know. But back then there wasn't that kind of language. So very delicately, mum and I wrote, and she listened and cried and hugged me. And you know, we did that process over about, you know, maybe 6 months. Because in the middle there, I actually took off to Tasmania to complete the book and compile it into an actual book. Oh. And then when I came back, I read her what I'd compiled. So it was a very healing process, basically. So that was the plot of that book. It was actually based on my mum and my life, Ken. And the second book, Another Man's Office, one, I had three sons, Ken, and I was desperately trying to understand male psychology. You know, my dad had died when I was 9. It had just been mum and I. Suddenly I got three boys, issues with their dads. What on earth is this? So I dived into a narrative about three generations of men to try and understand the male pressures and the dynamics between generations of men. I don't know how successful that was. It would take a man to tell me. But there were other issues. I was also very aware, and because I'd spent a lot of time in Asia by that stage, and I had always been quite triggered, I suppose, by, say, the hypocrisy of religious institutions or the people, the hypocrisy of the people who make up religious institutions. And that translates into questioning really what national identity is. And I think the last line of the second book is about the Australian character's passport and, well, we'll see how much worth that actually has. And I had no idea at the time that that comment was so controversial, but my second book was censored completely and the reviews of it were censored, which I didn't have time to notice until years later because Mum died at that time. The book was coming out, so I'm sorry. My focus certainly wasn't on the publication of my second book, but on my mum. Yeah. And I'd been told by my publisher that my book was politically dangerous, which completely, I was like, what? I am the least politically dangerous person I know, you know. You know, a total pacifist, and how can this be politically dangerous? I'm not that academically astute, or in retrospect, I understand to some degree what they meant, but it makes me really sad that that tiny little bit of just heartfelt questioning was considered politically dangerous.
Wow.
I mean, I do realise now that one of our ex-prime ministers, because the book's set in Burma, even though all the reviews say it's Thailand, that's part of the censorship, one of our ex-prime ministers had holdings in Burma.
Ah.
And still does, or the family legacy still does. So I hadn't realised, quite naively, I had gone and stepped on some...
Wow.
Hope that answers your questions, Ken.
Yes. Well, let's move on to literary awards. Now, here's a little list for you, and you are part of this list. Fiona Wright, Lucy Trelaw, Magda Zabanski, Elizabeth Harrower, Drusilla Majeska. These are people who've won these literary awards, the Kibble and the Dobby Award. And you won the Kibble for your first novel. How did that feel to be on that list?
What a list. Wow.
I was, it was really unexpected. And it really, really meant a lot to me. Because I'm also dyslexic, guys. So any old teachers out there who might still be alive, they know that I couldn't spell to save my life. And the way I had to learn grammar was I translated it into music, and that was my acting skill. So it was the rhythm of the speech, and everything I write is punctuated through a spoken rhythm out loud. So I might write quietly, but then everything is spoken. It was the only way I could wrap my head around that. So to be awarded that award, and for contribution to female literature, which is finding that voice, that was the motivation for the book. So for my mum and I, it really meant a lot to have that voice acknowledged. And so, and to find myself at, you know, the table with Helen Garner, was I was like, she was, you know, we'd all read you know, Monkey Grip, and she was just like, oh wow, like I couldn't believe it. And still to this day, kind of like, wow, yeah, well, you really did do that, Pam, you really were there. So it was all pretty amazing, and I went up to Sydney and they gave us a check, which was very helpful. And I thought the ceremony was over, and it wasn't. Then they called me back up and gave me a framed award, and I just broke down. It was so embarrassing. Like, I hadn't been expecting this actual award. You know, I was in mum mode, very practical. Oh, this money will help the kids and I can keep writing. But it was really that treadmill. But when they gave me the actual award, I just blubbered like a baby. It was this extraordinary recognition of I had worked so hard to learn to write, to learn to communicate, and here was this recognition of it. Wow. It was probably one of the most profound moments of gratitude in my life.
Amazing. Wow. Now, 2005 was your last TV acting credit that we saw on IMDb. So had you left the industry by then? You sort of had enough of acting and wanted to do other things? Or?
It was kind of a conflagration of a lot of things. I don't know if this was 2005. I'm not very good on the whole date thing. But I was playing a guest role in... Oh, God.
Lou Healers?
Lou Healers, I think it was. And I was playing a crazy religious fanatic woman who'd cut off her husband's balls.
As you do.
Anyway, and maybe part of this was because of the privilege of having been in Prisoner, where characters, you know, women ran the show. And as much as, yes, it was entertainment and some far-fetched things, which we can go into later, you know, it was strong in female story. So anyway, I'd gone from role to role to role, and there I was playing this crazy woman, and I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I can't keep portraying women who bear no relationship to the women I actually know. And I'm not saying all women are good, please don't get me wrong. But this was just such a banal caricature and really just didn't offer anything to discussion. Or, you know, maybe the whole industry was changing a bit by then, because the whole star system had come in and the producers from up top were dictating a lot more what the stories were. It wasn't that same grassroots dealing with grassroots issues as it had been earlier. So there was that. And there was also my agent, Barbara Gange, sold her agency. And, you know, there are certain things as an actress you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go to certain parties, remember certain people's names, know the hierarchy of who's more important. And I'm sorry, I'm just not good at that. I was never any good at it. You know, I bite my fingernails, I cut my own hair, I wouldn't be in the right place at the right time. I mean, work-wise, I was profoundly professional. But the other extracurricular stuff that drives that star system, I wasn't very good at. And Yeah. So I think I just withdrew. And at that stage, I was juggling three generations of children, because my kids are spread out over a really long period of time. So I was juggling a very distressed older child from his grandma's death and a whole lot of other stuff. Budding crazy middle one going into puberty and a tiny baby. So, you know, and various other extended family relationships. So I didn't really pursue finding another agent who would accept me as I was. So here we go.
Wow.
Now.
Here we go.
Okay, let me have a sip.
Let's take you and me back some 37 years.
God, kid.
To a show called Prisoner, which the fans are going to want to hear about. You appeared in 139 episodes over Series 7 and Series 8 from Episodes 509 to 650. How did you get the part of Lexi Patterson, and had you ever auditioned for any other roles before this, and had you seen the show prior to getting the role of Lexi?
Okay, so I'd never seen the show, Ken, because although my mum wouldn't let me watch it when I was younger. So she was incredibly open-minded about everybody else, but not her daughter. So although I'd watched endless other shows, I was never allowed to watch Prisoner. And I told you before about getting the show with getting the part with Jan, so I won't go over that. What was the other part of the question?
Now you're stretching my memory.
Had you auditioned for any other parts on Prisoner?
Yeah, did you audition? I mean, apparently at your audition, everybody was dressed up like Boy George.
Yes, I think they were, but I really wasn't.
But did you audition for any other parts apart from Lexi?
In Prisoner?
Hmm.
No, not in Prisoner.
Okay.
I don't think so. I mean, if I'm not lying deliberately, I don't think I did. Honestly, I've got a dreadful memory back then. I don't think I'd actually auditioned for any regular roles in series at that point. I'd done a lot of guest roles, and some of those had gone over 2-3 weeks, but I'd never auditioned for a regular role.
Okay. Now, Jan Russ, who we just interviewed in episode 44, it was amazing. What was it like meeting Jan for the first time?
Well, it wasn't meeting Jan for the first time.
Oh, you knew it prior. Okay.
Well, see, that's one of the things. I'd grown up as a child. So Ken doesn't remember me as a child in his studio, but I would have been there. I mean, I knew all these people. I'd watched them work. And I'd cooked dinners for my mum, and Jan had been part of that. And so I knew Jan as a person. The difference, Jan's extraordinary professionalism when I went in as an actress put me really at ease. It was a completely different relationship to anything outside of that. I went in as a young actress, like every other young actress, and it was about work. And she really gave so much. I mean, Jan's a really good actress herself. So she was a wonderful person to audition with because she embodied the character you were working with, whoever that was. She could be the big burly whatever, or the, you know, so you could actually really play a scene with her. And in that way, she really drew out your own performance. And I believe she gave that to everyone she auditioned. She'd calm you. It was really professional. There was time. You know, all us young actresses, we were so nervous, you know, all of us, when you went to an audition, and Jan would just calm it all. You'd work the scene, then you'd do a take, then maybe do another take. It was just, she had a real way about her that was very genuine, and you really felt she wanted the best out of each performer. Like, she drew that out of you in the audition process.
Yeah.
She's a wonderful
career. Yeah, 27 years on Neighbours. I mean, yeah. Wow, what a career.
Yeah, really, really wonderful.
Yeah.
Did you actually know any of the cast prior to starting taping the actual Prisoner show?
Well, I knew of them. I knew them as in, you know, Annie Phelan and Betty Bobbitt and Joy Westmore and Elizabeth Ballantyne and Liz Damon and just all the actors. I mean, I'd grown up with these people, but I had been not part of their world. I was that child on the periphery. So I knew most people, and the same with the crew. Like, you know, I knew the directors, a lot of them, and I knew a lot of the cameramen. But it was as Mari's daughter, this kid around. So coming into the show, I didn't really think about it that much. I just was there to be Lexi and in the working space.
Yeah.
I had my own validity and could actually be myself and my craft and learn and react off these fantastic performers. So, but there was also, I suppose, thinking back, like I didn't think of it at the time, but that knowledge, that knowing that went back, I sort of kind of cut that. That was something outside the workspace, if that makes sense. So other than oh, hey, Annie, or hi, Betty, or, you know, whatever, I let just our working relationship dictate how we were in the space. And I think that was both appropriate and there were no sort of issues or anything because of that. I mean, Mum and I, when I was in prisoner, we didn't actually see each other much.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So occasionally for things for my youngest son, Tushy, like as a family, but it was probably the period in my life when Mum wasn't on the phone all the time and we definitely never talked about work.
Yep.
Ever. And that privy into the inside world of the Grundys plotting and that I'd had by being at dinner parties and just being there doing cooking, whatever. I no longer did the cooking, they went out, and I no longer had that. And there was no discussion between studio and office. We never talked about work.
Wow.
For that time, I was in that show.
Yeah. Okay. The next question is like asking who your favourite child is. It's a hard one. And I don't expect...
Oh, my favourite child.
No, I'm not asking who your favourite child is. But, and because there were so many great performers on Prisoner, but who were you sort of looking forward to working with the most when you knew you got the part? Was there someone in mind that you thought, yeah, I can't wait to really...
Oh, look. So many of them. I'd actually, when I was about 15, Mum had taken me to see, sorry, I just got a message from my middle son. Mum had taken me to see a musical that Joy Westmore, Annie Phelan and Betty Bobbitt had been in.
Oh, wow.
Called The Glitter Sisters. And it was this fantastic performance. I was like 15. I was just in awe, like, you know, being a highly passionate 15-year-old. I'd sat there kind of weeping with joy at the amazing talent of these women. And so to walk, like, I was really working with people I respected so profoundly, and I felt really humbled to actually be sharing a stage, a set with these people and allowed to work with them on equal terms. And so, yeah, there were so many people, you know, Gerda Nicholson, Elspeth Ballantyne, Maggie Kirkpatrick, like these were names I'd grown up with, and suddenly to be really working with them on a daily basis, it was phenomenally exciting.
Yeah, it would have been. Wow.
Did you actually know how long you were going to be in it right from the beginning? Did you?
No, I had a 3-month contract to start with. So it went on from there.
Because that was the norm back then, wasn't it? You sort of got 3 months and then it would be extended and, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was the norm, you know. I just didn't really think about it. And then I was told it was going on. It was like, oh, wonderful, you know.
Now, I'm sure you probably didn't, but was there any ever tension on set from other cast members or crew members that you were the daughter of a producer? Because you were the only ever daughter of a producer on the show. Did you ever feel that from anyone?
There was only one incident and it really hurt. I'm sure in some ways having Mum as the producer and my respect for her and not wanting to tread at all on that maybe kept me a little bit more insulated in my own little, just the integrity of the work than maybe otherwise I'd have experienced. But there was only, so I never noticed. So if there was something for other people, they might say there was something for them, but I didn't
notice
that. But there was only one incident with one particular camera guy who I was really good friends with. I thought we were really good friends. And I still to this day don't know what happened, but I know I turned up on set and he'd lost his job. He'd been sacked. And I went up to him to go, what is this? What's happened? You know? And he just turned on me about, why didn't you tell me you were Harry Trevor's daughter? And I was completely, it really hurt. Because I, you know, and I've thought about that a lot over the years and thought, well, maybe something, like why would he have, what did that have to do with him being sacked? Like I still don't actually, and that was the only thing. And it really did hurt because I thought there was a really genuine friendship. And, you know, that question, why didn't you tell me? I didn't think it was relevant. You know, I didn't ever, you know, repeat anything that, you know, because we would make jokes, like it was hard work. Sometimes we'd all make jokes. I'd even make jokes like, oh God, you know, what do they expect us to do or whatever? But, you know, that's just letting off steam. It was, you know, and as I said, I didn't really see Mum during that time. So we certainly didn't talk about anything to do with anyone. So, yeah, that hurt a little bit. But it hurt because also this person who I cared about was obviously genuinely hurt, and I couldn't respond to it appropriately. Like it shocked me so much, I was just stunned. So I, you know, it hurt that they were hurt too.
Yeah, it would.
Yes. Well, we won't go into it anymore because I don't know this particular story, but can you tell me about, did your mum ever tell you what she thought of your portrayal of Lexi? She probably was smart enough not to.
Oh, thanks. I don't know whether that's a compliment or an insult, Ken.
No, I take it as a compliment because she was the producer, and it wouldn't have been probably even between yourselves ethical to make any comment. And I admired your mother a great deal. and having worked with her in the 70s. And I just have a feeling that she would have felt this is not something that we should discuss, because it either is going to be a positive or a negative, and neither would be of any advantage for you or for her.
Yeah, no, there was no, I mean, I know that my work was professional, and I know she respected that, if that makes sense, without her ever having to say anything. But I'd been brought up that way, you know, time is money. You know, learn your lines, be prepared, do what you're supposed to do, respect the crew, do what they ask you, you know, to the best of your ability. That was the minimum she expected of me, and I don't think I let her down in that way anyway. But no, we wouldn't have talked about anything else.
Yeah.
You know, to do with that.
Yeah, great. Now, your first scene was with Joy Westmore when you first come into the prison, and you're dressed as Boy George. What did you think of the whole Boy George? I don't know what you call it, but
Boy George look.
The Boy George look, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in one of the questions you sent me, you said some, you know, that was sort of a bit past by the time Lexi came on air, from when we filmed and stuff had happened or something. But I accepted what that was exploring. I mean, I actually like Boy George's music, you know, I thought he was great. So
early on. He was a fan of the show as well, wasn't he?
Yeah. And even his own image for himself, it was a discussion about a whole lot more. So it was actually quite appropriate for Lexi, who was, I mean, we didn't have language like this back then, but who was a young person in post-traumatic stress, you know, who was searching and finding, and it was an illusion and something she could hide behind, and yet in hiding could be more herself than she could if all that was stripped away. So, I mean, I actually think excuse me, guys, I've got to put my second pair of glasses on to see my notes, because I want to give credit to, I do have singles, but sometimes this works better. You know, it was the, where's it gone? The extraordinary, I'm looking for it, I can't find it. It was the extraordinary wardrobe and hair and makeup people who created that illusion for me. I mean, I just had to let them do what they did. There's actually a scene in The Hunger Games, at the beginning of the first Hunger Games, where she's being peeled and ripped, and every time I watch that, I go, that's what it was like being made up as Lexi that first time. You know, they did rip eyebrows, and I'm like, oh my gosh.
Was it a long process in hair and makeup to get that look?
At first it was a really long process, you know, like I still think I have Lexi eyebrows. I don't think they've ever quite back. But they peeled me and pulled me and dyed me and plucked me, and I was just like, okay. You know, but that process gave me this wonderful illusion to step into, which gave me a certain amount of freedom.
Yeah.
As it did the character of Lexi.
Yeah.
Now, Lexi had three very good friends, Bobby Mitchell, Marlene Warren, and Julie Egbert. Did you have to work on these relationships to get the right on-screen chemistry, or was it just a natural from the word go? And what are your memories of working with Maxine Clibbon Gatiss, killing alligators or whatever her name is, and Genevieve Lemon and Jackie Woodburn?
Oh, wow. It's okay. So No, I mean, all of those friendships, on-screen friendships and relationships, I mean, that's one of the beauties of working with amazing actors and performers. They embodied their character. Your job was to embody yours. And if you both did that, guess what? It just came together. By me embodying Lexi, by Maxine, definitely, you know, she'd been doing, you know, Bobby for ages. She just, it was second nature to her. Her enthusiasm, like I was very nervous stepping on the set in my own right.
Really? You know, you wouldn't have picked it on the show.
With all these actors who I had so much respect for, and the young ones who I was really blown out by the vibrancy and energy they brought to their characters. And because I'd had to have voice lessons. Oh, that was one thing Mum said. After she'd seen the interviews and she gave me that comment about Best of a Mediocre Bunch, I then got a call from my agent saying I had to go and have voice lessons because my accent was too English.
Oh, really? Wow.
Because when I was a small child, my dad had been actually playing Henry Higgins in Eliza, My Fair Lady. And so when he was rehearsing, he'd used me as Eliza and he'd put pebbles in my mouth. He was English. And he'd made me say, do all the exercises, like he really embodied the role.
Wow.
So I had to learn to speak very, very well. And apparently I spoke too well. That was my mum's only criticism to Jan. Like, she had to organise for me to go and have Australian voice lessons before I could play the role.
Wow. And you had pebbles in your mouth. That's it's funny you just bring that up. I was listening to a Sopranos podcast recently, and they were saying that what James Gandolfini, who played Tony Soprano, when he had some really aggro scenes coming up, he put some stones in his shoes, and while he was walking, that pain of the stones under his feet would give him that real angry look. It's amazing all these little things that you have to do as an actor to get those emotions.
Yes, I was only a child, Matt, and I think my dad really forgot how small my mouth was, because I can remember him putting them in and doing the scene, and I'm just going.
Wow. Now, earlier on in the interview, you mentioned Les Damon, who was also on Prisoner as one of the male prisoners. What was it like working with Les and that whole storyline about the male prisoners coming into the show at the time? What do you think of that?
Look, it wasn't, it certainly wasn't my place. I don't know if it was anybody's place to question the reality of that situation. I think this is sort of going a little bit backwards. Very early on, I think it was in when Lexi started to side with Lou Kelly. And I was very concerned about this from Lexi's, you know, who I created inside Lexi. And I think it was Bud Tingwall, actually, for some reason, that I said, I've got a real problem with this. And he just looked at me and said, make it work.
Oh, wow.
Under truth and make it work. So I never bought anything up again. I took but advice and I went, right, so that's the craft. Find a truth. Make it work. So I kind of knew that my mother's philosophy had always been, you'll probably remember her saying this, Ken, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. So that would be my response to the whole thing of the men coming into the female prison.
Look, yeah, there was some questionable stories in prison. We all know that. But...
very questionable stories in that way. But ours was not to reason why. It was, you know, it was about exploring issues, and you just had to find a way to accept the complete implausibility of the narrative. And remember, it's entertainment.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, I actually got to work with Les Damon on Homicide before this, and he was such a gentleman and such a nice guy. Peter Bensley, I think I'd worked with previously as well, but I'd never worked with Trevor Kent, and he turned out to be such a nice guy. He was just, he was totally opposite to
his character.
His character was so evil.
Yeah.
And he was just such a good guy. Yeah. A really nice bloke.
Yeah.
Now, I'm about to launch on to a bit of plot, and this is going to take a little time. Lexi was blackmailed by Alice Jenkins into helping her get revenge on alcoholic inmate Janice Grant for lagging, and together they force-fed her a methylated cocktail from the infirmary, which led to disastrous results, and Janice was found in agony scraping the walls with her fingernails. Take a breath. Lexi's guilt gave her way to Myra and provoked a furious reaction from nun Anita Selby. What did you think about Lexi doing that, and what was it like filming those very awful scenes?
Make it work. Really nothing else to say. It was very, very hard. I didn't believe that the Lexi I was embodying would have gone that way, but make it work. And I think Janice was amazing in that, because she was the victim in that situation. So it's kind of contradictory and hard to explain. One of the wonderful things about working in prisoner was that finally, as women, we got to be the protagonist, the antagonist. We got to express and to do stunts and be physical, show this physical, even if it was negative, this physical reality of womanhood or femalehood. And it was very emotional filming something like that. I think we were all aware that we wanted the portrayal to be as gruesome as it actually was. This was not something that we wanted to say was funny or cool, or we did want to try and show such appalling behaviour in it as true a light. If we had to do this, we wanted to portray it in as true a cruel a light as possible. And that was my job. And my head's just gone on name. Anyway, it doesn't matter. That was our job as the perpetrators. And the amazing thing of being able to arouse that energy, build it in a very short scene, because actually these were very short, intense but short, go in, that level of energy, and as soon as it was over, just all have a really big hug, that's gone, appreciate each other's performance, which really, it was really moving. Maybe have a little whoo, cry together and, you know, strengthen gone on to the next thing. So it was the quality of the actors that I was working with and an unspoken integrity about portraying something so awful, which was very hard to do.
Yeah. And Anita Selby, played by the amazing Diane Craig, great actress.
Yes.
That was a good storyline, the whole. I enjoyed that storyline that with the nun. Yeah. I think it was good. Yeah,
no, she was fantastic.
Yeah. Now, another harrowing scene I'm hoping you remember was in episode 528, where you had a dig at Joan Ferguson about her father, and she hacked off your hair. Was that a wig or was that your real hair?
Oh, no, it was a wig.
It was a wig, okay.
They dyed my hair to be black underneath, yep. And they'd made a wig that fitted around my own hair. So the front part was my hair and that grew down behind the wig, but they kept it black until that scene. I mean, Maggie's an extraordinary performer. Like, I mean, I never watched Prisoner, but I have since you found me, Matt, watched a few episodes, and I found myself completely mesmerised by a totally silent scene that Maggie, in one of the episodes with Maggie, where she breaks. Just, and I watched this and just went, this is the depth of this actress, that she's just phenomenal. So as always with Maggie, you know, a crack and a joke as you're walking onto set, and you know, she just makes you feel comfortable and welcome. The moment that came, that, you know, action was called, we were both in our character realities, and her professionalism really enabled me to hopefully mirror her and be in my own characters. We lived that for that moment.
Yeah.
We lived that. The emotion was really real on both sides. I mean, having a go at her father, you know, and Lexi knew, having her own issues with parents, that this is, like, it was really quite vicious, but in that way it was exploring the passion of those hereditary family narratives for people, which I think we both honoured in our own way. And doing the stunt of the hair cutting and the physicalization of that, it was just fantastic. I mean, that's one of the things I adored about working with other such professional actresses who were reveling in having a physical reality and having stunt coordinators who'd work with us, because as women, you never got that. Yeah. It's the guys doing that, you know, but suddenly as women, we were allowed to embody physical beings, whether it be good or bad. And I think that scene between Lexi and the freak really embodied that.
Amazing. Great scene.
Can you tell us what it was like in episode 533? What was it like dressing up for and filming or taping Marlene and Matt's wedding?
Oh, it was a complete hoot. It was just like so incongruous. Suddenly we're in these pink frilly things and this wedding happening with, like, I thought I was in a different show.
I don't know how many weddings are happening in prisons at the moment.
Make it work, Pep. Don't question it, like, just make it work. But it did feel really, I mean, one thing I would say about it is, you know, the difference in the tension levels when you were filming really intense, quite aggressive narratives or storylines. It's just like light fluff. It was a really easy week.
Yeah, the great scene. Now, speaking of intense scenes, do you remember much about the terrorist siege, which went over three episodes? They were quite long.
Everyone wants to. I mean, Ken, you will remember how we shot things. So part of the magic of television is that it all came together with this intense energy, and but how it was actually shot, we did half a day's filming, all us women in one cell or the places we had to be. We weren't even around, sweetie. Then it was focused on the leads in those episodes, those intense reactions. So the magic of television is that we did our responses. We didn't know what the whole would be like till it was cut together.
Well, you had some great scenes in those episodes, though, throwing the fry pan of fat on one of the terrorists, and Annie Phelan's last episode, her being killed. Did you feel a bit different on set knowing that was her last episode as well?
Look, I think one of the things about Prisoner is that people always came and went.
Yeah.
It was never a stagnant... So that there were always people coming in. That was part of the narrative. It was more fluid. It was exploring change. So it was really, had been amazing working with Annie. And it was really different to lose her presence as a person who was very funny. Like Annie and Maggie and Betty Bobbitt and Elizabeth Ballantyne and Joy Westmore, they had this wonderful ability of cracking a joke. You'd all have a laugh. Everyone would be relaxed and bang. And they taught us to do that too. So that as soon as action was called, everyone was in it. There was already energy circulating. It wasn't dead or stultified. There were no tensions between people that weren't, yeah, there were no actual tensions between actual people. It was all just clean slate for the characters we were playing, and we were all given the space to do that. So in that sense, I think it was really strange losing that central, one of those central pivotal professionals who had specially held all us young ones together. But that was part of the narrative of also our characters were lost, yeah, and that was the top dog. So I think it all worked pretty, pretty well.
Yeah, that was amazing, that episode. I mean, because you knew what was going to happen. Like you saw Myra go, and then it was Nora, played by Sonia Talis, who shot the terrorists. You knew that she was next in line, step in, top dog. Yeah. Took you on that emotional roller coaster of top dog's gone, this will be the new one. Yeah.
But that didn't last too long.
Yes. That's true.
Yeah.
Now, at the end of episode 574, Lexi got into a fight with Lou Kelly. Can you share your memories of filming that scene with Louise Siverson? And also, in episode 593, Lou decides to take advantage of a faulty plug socket in the kitchen to electrocute Lexi in revenge, believing Lexi to be the Phantom Lagger, convinced by manipulative Eve Wilder, who is in fact the real Phantom Lagger. Can you tell us about that as well?
Okay, well, I mean, I think I need to go back a little bit and say I've mentioned all these other really well-known actresses that I was in awe of when I went into the show. But I was actually in awe of Louise Siverson. The reason for that was well before I went into the show, I had been cooking for Mum. She had, I think Coral was there and whoever else, you know, Tony Ossica, Gail Mellion, Neil Luxmore, Tiny McMahon, Kit Oldfield, like they'd all been there having dinner and I'd been cooking, and there was some conversation about they needed a, you know, the violent, aggressive character. They hadn't quite worked out who that was going to be, how they were going to draft that. And there was a line in an episode, just one line, and they needed the Lou Kelly character, or they needed a character like Lou Kelly to say this one line. Well, they sorted out who the baddie was going to be. And they'd given it to Lou Siversen, who had originally come into the show as an extra, I think. I might be completely wrong.
No, you're right, 100%.
That was what I understood. And in the background, Lou had really created Lou Kelly. You know, she'd done her own hair, she'd create, and she worked at it. Like she, you know, as my mother would say, there are no small parts, only small actresses. And Lou was never a small actress, and it might have been as an extra, but she lived it in the background. She included the other extras. Like she was quite extraordinary. And I still hold that same respect for Lou. I'm not sure I've ever met an actress who works so hard at her craft as Lou. She's quite incredible. So anyway, there'd been this dinner party, and I had heard this conversation about really we don't have to create out of thin air this antagonist. We have her there in Lou Siversen.
Oh, wow.
It was this comment about how she had delivered this line. Might have been two lines, I don't know. But basically, they then went and created Lou Kelly out of what was already created.
Wow.
And I'm not sure that Lou Siversen has ever actually received the credit for that. You know, probably back then it was a legal thing where it, you know, they if they gave her credit or something, maybe they'd have had to pay. I don't know. But I think it's really important that people understand what an extraordinary performer she is, and not just performer, but the depths of her creativity in creating that whole character in relation to the characters that were already established. Yeah. So, consequently, go in and... Lou and I became very fast friends. I love Lou dearly to this day. I think she's an extraordinary human being and an extraordinary performer. So we both, being very physical people, we love doing the stunts. Wow. And we had the best stunt guys. And I feel really awful that just now their names have gone from my head. Ken, can you help me? Can you remember?
No, I really can't.
Anyway, they were fantastic, and we were really allowed to make that physical, you know, explore how we could do. We didn't have the male way of doing it imposed on us by them. We were allowed to find out how as women we would do these things. And I've watched a few of Lou Kelly and Lexi's interactions in the last couple of weeks, and it's brought a smile to my face that, you know, we both just embodied that antagonism and playing with each other. And I mean, from my side, I can't speak from Lou's side, but from my side, it was so enjoyable working with someone you trusted and being so nasty.
She was amazing. I mean, watching the riot episode that she was in, and she was like next level. She was so good. I mean, she was always good, but
yeah.
Just those episodes in particular stand out to me that she, you know, her character had lost the plot. Just it was all in. Everything was in, all the chips were in. It was amazing.
All the chips were in, yeah. And, you know, Lou really, I don't think anybody could ever say that, you know, there's a presence that actors can have when they come on screen. It's just an energy that surrounds them. And Lou bought that, like, bang, That energy was just vibrated through Lou Kelly all the time once when we were on set.
When she came on the show, she said the hair was from, she tip her head upside down and spray a whole can of hairspray. That's how the hairstyle started.
So you see, I had people who created my visual look. She did it all herself.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Amazing. Speaking of Kit Oldfield, he directed the episode that I'm about to talk about where you escaped from Wentworth because of Lou Kelly. She thought you were the Phantom Lagger. Now, actually, what the fans don't know is you created that. Was that you that created the name, the Phantom Lagger?
Oh, yeah, apparently. I didn't remember that until I watched the episode the other day. I'm like, wow, Pep, your character created that name, I think, at least in the episode I saw. Maybe it had come up before.
Now, you escaped through the air conditioning vents. Was that the real vents that you were getting into, or was that?
No. They'd actually put up some fake venting, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So they were the right size, and I really enjoyed doing all that. I really did. It was just so much fun. I enjoyed doing that. And ironically, before we met and I triggered my memory, Ken, one of the things I really remember was the electrocution scene with Lou Kelly in the kitchen. Like, I remember it was first seen up early in the morning. Something had happened with Tush. He'd had measles or a fever all night. And I just remember the absurdity of walking onto the set and having to, you know, within 3 seconds be electrocuted. Citizen and I just pissed ourselves laughing after it was over. So, sorry, going back to our last question. But, the escape and going through the tunnels, that was really fun.
There was a lot of faulty plugs in Wentworth. It was
heaps of faulty plugs. It's a wonder any of us survived.
Yeah, no, I mean, they were great. So I loved your character in Prisoner, but I love seeing the scenes that came after the escape, going to the brothel and working with Val Gelay, which we'll talk about shortly. So we'll go on to Ken's question. Everyone's...
Tell us about the dog, Poco.
Guys, I would love to do that, but if I do not have a coffee now, can we take a 10-minute break?
Well, no, we can wrap up, actually, because, I mean, we're nearly at 1:15, so we can talk
about... I'm happy to go on, but I need a coffee and a 10-minute break.
No, we can talk about this in part two. That's okay. Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, we'll do it because, we're halfway through, so... No, it's been amazing. The last few hours have been an absolute blast. It's been so much fun to speak with you and learn about your life, and the fans will love this, and part two will be even more fun, more Prisoner fan questions.
I'd like to thank the fans. It really means a lot that the energy we all put into our characters and the show touch people so much, and it's a really, that's been very humbling.
Yeah. It has. Anything you want to add, Ken, before I do the wrap up?
Yes, just one thing. Talking about Bud Tingwall and make it work. He was such a lovely guy, and I was very honoured to actually get to work with him. As a director, and I find it sad that he is no longer with us, because I'm absolutely sure it would be such a fantastic thing to work and interview him as well.
Yeah. Bud, if you could interview Bud, I mean, I know his career spanned right back to the beginning, like my mother and father's, and they had spent time doing rep in London. You know, Bud stayed on longer than my father, who came back, but they were contemporaries in London. And, you know, they came out of a really harsh but profoundly crafted theatre background, both of them. And Bud had this amazing way of translating that into two-hour-a-week television. And he was one of the few actors from that time who didn't, he would say it was because of his wife, Audrey, that he didn't get lost in the ego swings and I guess psychological demons that a lot of the actors from those times really did get lost in. Audrey, yeah, who he was with for his whole life, was his anchor.
Wow.
And she was a very gentle, quiet woman. And their relationship was a really beautiful thing to witness. And I think allowed Bud to stay grounded through it all. He was just such a lovely man.
He was, definitely. Well, that was episode 45 of Talking Prisoner. Please like and subscribe to our YouTube channel and share this interview everywhere you can. And please also follow our Facebook page, Instagram, Twitter, and all the other social media platforms. And this episode will be available across all the podcast platforms, iHeartRadio, Amazon, Google, and wherever you get your podcasts from, and the talkingprisoner.com website. Thank you so much, Pepe. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Yes. Bye, Ken. See you soon.